Welcome to another Forgeside Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between. And today we've got a little bit of a special episode. We're diving outside of Canada once again, actually going across the pond, if you will. Not the normal pond that people refer to, the other pond on the other side, heading down to Australia with our mate, Timothy Mitchell. Timothy Mitchell is coming in from Buffalo River Forge, or you might know him from Alpha Omega Knives. You might also know Timothy as being the co-founder and president of the International Woot Society. Timothy has been working really hard at establishing a world-renowned group of people that are very, very much at the cusp of everything Woots that is going on right now. If you need to know things about Woots, these are the guys that know what's going on. We've got high-end metallurgists involved in this, guys that are been dealing with Woots for years and years and years. I've read tons of books. If you listened to the last episode, or if you did listen to the last episode, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. These are gentlemen that take metallurgy very seriously, and I'm excited to sit down with Timothy today because he's been putting in a ton of work. In the last 5 years, he's been really focusing on getting this Woot Society going and getting all the information out there for people to really know what Woots is. So welcome to the show, Timothy. Thank you for coming aboard, bud.
Thanks, Lando. Appreciate it. Good to be on.
It's pretty cool to sit down with somebody from Australia. It is 6 o'clock at night here right now. What time is it there?
It's 10 a.m.
And you're a day ahead of me, essentially, as well, right? Right.
Yeah, we're over the international date line.
That's pretty crazy.
It does kind of get weird.
The sun's going down here, but the sun's been up there for a little while. And it's summer there, right?
It is summer here, yes. Yeah, we're actually heading out of summer. It's been normally this time of year, things start to get cooler. We're starting to go into autumn, fall, as you guys call it. And right. This has been an unusual one. We've still been getting high 30s. And mid-30s weather, so it's a little bit late.
What is typical fall, winter weather for you?
Well, we're halfway up the coast, mid-north coast area, about 4 hours north of Sydney. And so it's pretty mild, really. Melbourne is just really, it's wet, it's miserable, it's cold. Here, you get the odd frost. The odd bit of rain coming and going, but it's not definitely like some other places. It's actually quite a pleasant mix between Queensland, the warm, really warm weather up there, and the really cold weather down south.
Cool. That's awesome. But you're hitting like high 30s in the summertime, 40s, that kind of
sometimes
weather.
40s. Yeah. Look, on a hot year, we could go, mid to low 40s.
Oh, ouch. Ouch. Yep. That hurts.
It does. Yep.
So especially go ahead.
So especially if the heat index is up, that's brutal.
Yeah. Like if the humidity is high and whatnot. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. We very rarely hit the 40s here or high 30s is kind of like once, maybe a week of it or whatever type thing, 2 weeks of it. But so sounds like it's similar summer-ish weathers. They're definitely not the same winters we get, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. So we were chatting before we kind of started recording here about some of the people that you've got involved in the society with you right now. You are the co-founder and president of the society.
Yes.
The other gentleman that helped you found that would be Peter Burt, Jin Singh, Mert Tansu, and Sebastian Solesky, is that right?
Sokalski,
thank you.
Yep. He's from iPost Swords.
Sorry, from where?
He's iPost Swords on Instagram.
iPost Swords?
Yep.
I've never heard of that
and
before.
On YouTube.
Okay,
yep.
Cool.
He's a collector and historian type thing.
Yep. You'll have to apologize. You'll have to forgive me. I'm
not a problem.
Huge into the sword system or game at this point. I'm walking into it slowly here. I'm taking baby steps because this world is mind blowing to me when I look at it. And the you get into sword making, you better know what the hell you're doing, right?
Like is true. Yeah, I don't make swords, so I haven't been set up for it. It takes a slightly different setup, and I haven't had the interest. My interest personally is the steel and getting the most out of the steel, and I've always tended to focus on, you know, hunting and utility knives, that sort of thing. So,
okay,
but, not to say I wouldn't make swords down the road. I've had people ask me, "Hey, will you make me a sword?" And it's like, yeah, just here. One of my friends, he can take care of you.
nice.
Yeah.
So these gentlemen that you got involved with to start the society, where did that, you had the Bulat Woots page on Facebook, and there was kind of some beginnings there with that, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, well, I started out on Primal Fires back many, many, many moons ago. So that was anybody who's been, you know, in the bladesmithing community, Bloomery Iron, Woot Steel, they'll remember, you know, at least back 20 years ago, they'll remember Primal Fires, which was one of the first forums that was out there. And then we had Don Fogg's forum, and then Bladesmith's forum, which has had quite an active Woot Steel, Woots Makers, Bloomery Iron type of group. And then there's on Facebook, there's two groups. One is Iron Smelters of the World, and then there's the Woots Bulat page on Facebook, group on Facebook. And so I've been involved with them as admin, moderator, admin for at least since 2014. It might have been earlier. So close to 10 years.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Cheers to that.
Cheers. So, yeah, the whole idea for the society started back prior to COVID. I've been friends with Rick Furrer, Nico Heinonen, Peter Burt, and several other prominent Woots makers. We've been rubbing shoulders for years. So, we periodically chat and ask each other questions and toss ideas, because you've got to have a sounding board, someone who is kind of on the same sort of level as you. You have to be able to talk to them about, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And discuss theories of pattern formation and problems that you're having. And so we back, it was several, like a year before COVID, we started this chat group. It was a Instagram kind of private chat group, chat thread. And we had a whole bunch of the prominent smiths on there. And we were talking about all these things and hashing out ideas, refining each other's skills and knowledge, working out problems that each of us had with processes, etc. And so I was able to convince most people to go with thermocouples in their furnaces. So, if you don't know what temperature you're hitting, then you basically suck it and see and hope for the best.
Okay, so, I hate to interrupt you real quick though. Yep. What thermocouple are you guys using?
Okay, we generally use Type S thermocouples because they're cheaper. You can get them on AliExpress for about $20-$30. Okay. And you got to be careful with them. The wires are fine, but they do, and you get the odd dodgy one, but they are, good thermocouples. And they give you, if you calibrate your furnace, and by calibrate, I mean you whack a piece of pure iron, some iron powder flakes or whatever, in a crucible with the lid off, you fire it up, and you using welding glasses, you watch and check it until it melts. And when it melts, you've reached 500 and whatever it is degrees.
Oh.
554, the melting temperature of pure iron. And so that tells you that this temperature on my thermocouple meter is now, it might say 1580 or something. But in your crucible, it's at a lower temperature. Right. And so then that's how you calibrate it. So you know what your percentage of error is. You mark how far the thermocouple is sticking into your furnace wall. And you're good to go.
Interesting. Very cool. Yeah. I'm glad I asked that because I've heard a lot of people talking about trying to temperature control their furnace or their forge, and that's the thermocouple seems to be the issue. The guy's going with the K-type thermocouple, and that's what I've heard in the past. I haven't heard the S-type.
Yeah, K-type is 1150, 1200 degrees maximum, usually. Yeah. And so, you know, so if they've got thicker wire, they can last longer before they melt. So that's why they use them, generally speaking, in forges. But when you go to a furnace, we're talking about, we're going up to between 1550 and 1600 degrees centigrade here. Mm. You go too much higher than that, you can get problems. But
so we're talking like an electric kiln then at that point?
No, usually, generally we use, the most common one is propane. So really? Or over here we call that LPG, liquid petroleum gas.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so that is the most common furnace. Then you can use a charcoal furnace if you want, like a coke or charcoal. They're a little bit more problematic, a little bit harder to control the temperature, and a little bit harder to sense the temperature. But they work.
What's the difference between a forge and a furnace then?
Okay. So a forge is you can have horizontal and vertical. You use it to heat the metal to bang it. And it's not built to handle the temperatures that a furnace, a melting furnace, would be experiencing. And so you have to design a melting furnace more specifically to handle up to like 1700 degrees centigrade.
Okay. I might be ignorant on this one, and I apologize. What the terminology in my mind that I'm thinking of when you're talking about a furnace would be what I know is called a foundry.
Yeah, and a foundry, the way I perceive that, and it might be incorrect, but foundry is usually, you know, where you pour molten metal, that sort of thing. So they're similar.
Okay.
So like in a foundry, you'll have a kiln, you'll have the furnace, and in the big steel foundries, and they'll move this massive crucible into the furnace, close the doors, and they'll heat it up. Yeah. It might have to sit there for, 10 hours or more to get to temperature. Right. And then once it's at temperature and you've got your mix of carbon, right, you've got your mix of different alloys that you want to put in there. And so if you're doing cast iron, you might want to put some manganese in there or some other things to make it ductile, depending on what type of cast iron you want. And then you'll pull that out, and they have a crane and they pour it out.
Yeah.
So of course with Woots, you don't pour it.
Yes, right.
So you've got a crucible, you put the crucible in a furnace, which is just basically a combustion chamber with insulation around it. Mm-hmm. And then you have either coal, charcoal or coal, a coke in there as the fuel source, or you use gas. And most people, as I said, use gas. You can do an induction furnace. You can melt it. Not many smiths have been doing that up until this point.
Yeah, the induction game's kind of picking up lately, hey?
Yeah, it is. It takes a massive amount of electricity. I wouldn't even dream of playing with that over here in Australia. The electricity prices are through the roof. It's ridiculous.
We got it pretty good here where I am in Manitoba. We've got a lot of hydroelectric dams here, so it's cheap electricity here. I've really thrown around the idea in my head, and I've thrown it out to a few other people, the idea of an induction forge where it's not just your copper coil that you put your piece of steel in, but it's actually a copper coil through a fire brick system, so that it not only is heating your piece of steel, but it's also heating up the fire brick, so it holds that heat after you're done doing your cycle, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I would think that there would be some issues with, because the whole, you'd have to keep on pumping your cooling fluid through the coil. And also to do with, from my limited experience, I've got a friend who uses induction quite heavily, and he tells me that you've got to have specifically designed shaped coils.
Yep.
And so if you go too large, then it's not, get too far away from the steel, then it's not going to actually heat it properly. you got to have it close to the steel and have it, otherwise, if you don't have it close enough to the steel, then you can get the surface effect where it's just heating the surface. You generally want to heat it all the way through. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine it would use a lot more power, being for the larger the coil. So, but look, it's worthwhile looking into, and you don't know these things unless you come up with an idea and explore it.
I have to be honest, the main reason that idea came to my brain is I work in research and development and building battery electric vehicles.
Cool.
One of the things that I see in our future is the loss of use of natural gases and combustion fuels. It's going to be regulated to the point where it's not allowed for home use, and we're going to have no choice but to use electricity. When it gets to that point, what are our options going to be?
Yeah.
So that's where that's like.
Well, of course, if you're in Australia, you just have to set up a large Fresnel lens on a hot summer's day and you're good to go.
have you actually heard of anybody doing that? Because I have.
I've seen people melting rocks with them and that sort of thing. We've been discussing the concept of having kind of a spherical reflector, stainless steel reflector, using it to melt woots. I think that'd just be awesome trying that.
If you go back to episode 24, John and Nancy Little, John worked with a gentleman through, I believe it was through the University of Dalhousie, which he was a professor at one point as well. But the gentleman that he worked with created a massive thing of mirrors and magnifying glass. He said that it would melt the steel almost instantaneously. It would get it so hot.
I would not be surprised. Yeah.
The concept, it's out there. If you guys want to look into what John's done, you might find something interesting there. Yeah.
Yep.
So you started playing around with metal around 99, you were telling me, kind of established Buffalo River Forge in the early 2000s while you were living in the United States.
In Tennessee.
So you went from Australia to Tennessee, then back to Australia again. What's going on here, man? What took you to the States? What brought you into the world of metal? How did this all start, dude?
Well, we moved to America because we were involved in radio syndication, my father and I. And so he was doing a country music, Christian country radio program. And kind of that morphed and developed as we spent time over there. And I ended up that I was doing the editing, doing the producing and mixing and all that sort of thing of the program. Nice. So that was, it's still going today in over in Australia here. We've got, I don't know, 30 stations that are still running it. So.
Oh, awesome, bud.
Yep. So that's why we went over there. And then I got caught up in building sound studios, because electronics was one of my, you know, areas of expertise. And then before Y2K, you know, around 99, 98, something like that, we moved onto a farm about an hour away from Nashville. So I was born in the country, you know, not a big city fan. And so that was really enjoyed that. And I wanted to learn blacksmithing. And there was a guy who was offering an anvil and a few other bits and pieces for sale. And so I went, I just called him up, and he ended up being Ken Scherabock, who was kind of a legend at the time as far as just homesteading, blacksmithing, that sort of thing. Cool. And he wrote heavily in Countryside magazine back in the day. And so he gave me my start in blacksmithing, taught me a bit, and I ended up going to the Southern Ohio Forge and Anvil Convention SOFA in 99. And he roped me in to volunteer there. And as part of that, I was able to sit in on a lot of the different demonstrations that were there. And Howard Clark was helping Daryl Meyer with a demonstration on this one particular session. And Howard was talking about this work that was being done by Al Pendre and John Verhoeven, With Woots. And I didn't know anything about Woots by that name. I knew about some of the traditions, the Russian Bulat traditions. I didn't realize it was basically the same material.
Crazy.
Yeah. I've got a friend who's Russian, and he was telling me about these Zlatoust swords that were legendary and all this sort of stuff that Anisov made back in the 1800s. So I ended up, he showed this piece of steel he'd made a knife out of a piece of Woots, and I was hooked. And he said that Al had rediscovered this whole how to make it and all that sort of thing, and that it, you know, had been lost and then refound, and which it's never actually was lost, but that's another story. but you know, Al discovered the mechanism of banding. Al and John did, and so I said to Howard that I hope that he's confided this information in someone so he doesn't kind of take it to his grave, and not realizing that I was going to be one of the people who he was going to be confiding in.
Wow.
So I did the deep dive, hopped on Primal Fires, and I'd worked out 99% of the process, and there was basically one piece of information concerning patterning that I did not actually understand and did not know. And I called John Verhoeven. I tend to do that, just call people out of the blue, say, "Hey, John, tell me." And he's a very nice guy. Yeah, and he shared with me a little bit of what he knew. But he said, "Look, you really need to talk to Al. Al's the one who knows all the information on this." And because John is a metallurgist. And so he did the paperwork, the documentation and interpretation of what Al had been coming up with. But yeah, John has a lot of irons in the fire. And Al was the one who was focusing mainly on the Woots.
So what was Al's life into this? Was he a metallurgist as well, or just a blacksmith?
He was a farrier.
Wow.
He was a farrier and knife maker.
Cool.
Yeah. And so I called Al up and I said, "Hey, you know," had a chat with him about his, the Woots making and all that sort of thing. And he just flat out told me basically his entire process.
Wow.
Which was very, awesome. Very, very rare. And then I called him the next day to clarify something. And I mean, I was a greenhorn back then. I didn't even know what a phase diagram was.
Right.
And so he ended up, he said, "Look, I've talked to my attorney since we've last talked." And he said, "I told you too much."
Oh,
and he said, "I've actually violated some of our patent stuff." So he said, "I tell you what," he said, "if you tell anyone what I told you, I'll break your arm." But he said that I'd be happy to mentor you.
Well,
and
cool.
So he said that he's been looking at that point. He was wanting to have a few young people that he wanted to invest in to share his knowledge, who could carry on with the work. And so that was, I really appreciated that. And so until the time that he passed on, we were periodically in communication. I never actually met him in person. Because I lived in Tennessee, he was in Florida, and my ability to travel back in those days was not great. And so I was just, I'd call him up and we'd talk for hours. He could talk. Anybody who knows him knows how well Al could talk. He was full of stories. And you'd call to talk to him about one thing, and you know, you'd end up on a bunch of rabbit trails, and it was great. Yeah, it was very rich, and you know, I've still got my notes from those days of the things that he told me, and so I've got it documented. And that's interestingly though, John Verhoeven and Bill Dorsch, who worked with Al on their papers, co-publishers, they remember the old paper stuff, the original experiments and what was written down, but neither of them know his original process, the actual process that he developed. And so I'm glad that was preserved. That was how I got involved. And from that point on, I started making Woots and got involved eventually with, came back over here as well and got involved with the Facebook groups. And I've posted quite heavily on the Bladesmith forum. And then we started this we started this chat on Instagram. And once that was, we did that for about a year. It was awesome. Really, a really fertile discussion group. And we all really loved it. And eventually we ended up shutting that down and moving over to the Woot Society. But I started around about just as it was, well, just into COVID, I talked to Peter Burt and Jin Singh, and we were discussing, because they were both very active on that group, and I opened it up to a few other Smiths, and they're like, no, we're fine. We've got too much. We have too much on. We really don't. We're okay doing what we're doing, so we don't really need to be involved in the society, which is fine. They're doing really well on their own. Mm-hmm. But I talked to Peter and Jin, and they both recognized that there was a need for a society to have. Well, there was a couple of reasons why we started the society. And it was basically Jin, myself, and Peter who started it. We kind of did the brainstorming initially. And then we roped in Sebastian and Mert Tansu of Tansu Knives. And that was really, they helped us work out the whole, the constitution, all that. And it just, that, the paper pushing was a real pain to deal with. But
mm-hmm.
once we actually launched in July of last year and opened up for members. Before that, we were working on forum, website, all that sort of stuff. And because it's an international group. And so we need to have a platform where people of different languages can talk freely, with translation, Google Translate and all that sort of thing, automatic on the page. And okay. so sometimes it plays up. So we get the odd bit of Spanish or whatever. And it's like, okay, click, copy, throw it into Google Translate. Oh, there we go. That's what they're saying. But no, it's very good. And but the reasons why we started the society were, there were several. We realized that we needed to firstly combat the misinformation that was out there, which it is vast. Anybody who's really studied Woots, there's so much conflicting information, and I still get blown away by the nonsense that some people, even in academia, say. I have a lot of respect for the academics out there. It's just sometimes, like, this one thing I heard yesterday was, I don't know who it was, but someone said that the elements that are in the Woot steel actually came from the air. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. was just, I don't know who that was, but that kind of came across my desk yesterday from one of our, he was actually talking to someone who had been doing research with some academic people, trying to get informed for something they were working on. And that was one of the comments that came out. I was like, okay, well, someone's not understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
So that was one thing, that the whole myths and misconceptions. We want to try and help people become aware of the rich history of the material, and not just, oh, it's just a steel. No, there's a lot of rich history behind it, and we should have an appreciation for that. Just like te mahogany and other steels, there's a rich history. Other traditional steels, there's a rich history behind it. Even, talking about the Damascus pattern welded saxes and stuff like that, back from the Roman times, and there's a lot of rich history in metallurgy, and if you just look at the material by itself without the context of the history, you lose a lot. We also wanted to provide a group where it was easy for people to get mentoring, to get accurate information, so they could start making Woots, become part of a community, and contribute to the community, and then be able to make good quality steel with the ability of being certified, so that we have a certification program, Journeyman Wootsmith, Master Wootsmith, so that you can, if you're able to make steel to a particular standard where the blades will pass specific tests, and this is, cutting and bending tests, kind of like the ABS, but without a lot of the extra stuff. So But fit and finish, this is about the steel. It's not about your fit and finish and all that sort of thing. So I don't know, the ABS, they really get very strong on the fit and finish, and there's a place for that.
Totally, right?
Yeah. But now our focus is, can you make steel that a customer has ordered to a high quality and to be able to perform?
My understanding, a lot of that is going to be depicted in pattern as well. What about doing an analysis of the steel itself, like doing a spectrograph?
Okay, so we have been on the side privately doing analysis of historical blades. So
that's what I got out of the conversation I had last night there with Rick. Mm-hmm. And Kyle is they've been collecting any broken whoops they can come across. Yep. And it's the main reason for that is you don't want to break a nice piece of Woot's, you know, historic blade. So these ones that are broken are perfect for dissecting to start getting the science behind this Woot's and the different years, the lineage of where it came from will also really change what you're seeing in a lot of that, right?
Absolutely. When you, what's what we use, we'd like to be able to just take sections and do acid, where you dissolve a piece of metal in acid and then you do a optical emission spectrograph.
Right.
That is the most accurate method of, you know, you get down to a couple of parts per million on your carbide forming elements. And that's, look, that is important to get some of that information. There's some steels that are so pure, some Woot steels that are so pure that you only have some carbide forming elements are undetectable by a standard, like standard testing. And that's one of the biggest problems we've had for years. The academics don't understand how that such small amounts can have such a major effect in the steel. And so when they do the analysis, they don't go far enough. They don't check for enough elements. They'll go maybe to 100 parts per million, and that's where they stop.
Right.
And that's not enough. We need to go down much lower than that.
Really?
So
wow.
For a long time, for years, I've been trying to get people, you know, academics, I've talked to quite a few different people in academia, and saying, hey, we need three things. One is we need the elemental analysis down to a high resolution. We also need under the microscope, micrographs, you know, photographs of the microstructure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need, because that tells you whether it's perlite, spherodite, whatever. What are you looking at? And then, because that tells us also how it was heat treated, also how it was forged. And then you need macro photographs of the actual surface pattern. They'll do analysis, but they won't do the other two. Or they'll do analysis and just micrograph, but they'll focus on just one tiny spot. And then they won't go and do, you won't be able to see the bigger picture because there's a lot more information that can be gleaned from getting those three pieces of information. So we've been working on that. We've been analyzing blades. We've been doing it using spark erosion, which is what John Verhoeven has been doing. You know, in the past, he was using spark erosion. Al Pendre's papers with him, that was, the analysis was quite accurate. They went down to, I don't know, was it 10 parts per million or something, which is reasonable. There's not a problem going down that far. And so we've been looking at these and being able to see trends in the patterning. And in my years of mentoring smiths and seeing, I find that by teaching and mentoring, I actually learn a lot more than just by doing it myself. It's incredible. Yeah. And so I would see they put molybdenum in it and wow, okay, the pattern changes. There's a characteristic, you know, a person who doesn't necessarily is not familiar with the patterns so much. Like, oh, just the same sort of pattern. Yeah, but no, you can actually see there are very specific characteristics. Higher manganese, you start getting shadow lines and different things on the pattern. You see that in the traditional blades as well. And, you know, we can't say that they're manganese lines. They may be, they may not be, it may be something else. But you do get macro segregation with certain elements that are in there. And so we've been able to see these trends. And, you know, you put a bit, if the phosphorus is higher, then the blade actually looks different. Like the steel that was made, the crucible steel that was made in Egypt, which most people don't know that it was made in Egypt, was made in Spain as well. It was made in Constantinople.
Right.
It was also made in, this is one of the misconceptions, let's call it. Crucible steel was made in Damascus. And you read pretty much all of the scholars and they say, nah, wasn't made in Damascus.
It was only traded there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And they are correct if you're looking from the 14th century onwards.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Totally, yeah. Totally.
When you look at Al-Kindi, Al-Tartusi, Al-Biruni, those guys, the Arab original, because they spoke Persian. They were writing in Arabic in those days. And so you got to go to the Arab records to see what was happening. And so when they say, it's like I think it's Al-Kindi from the 8th century AD. He says that there is, you know, he talks about native steel. Native steel that is made from in a particular location from the ore in that location. And so he said that one of those locations, he talked about Khorasan, he talked about around Babylon area. Mm-hmm. He talked about Damascus, and that Damascus was one of these locations where they actually did make crucible steel. Poulard is what he called it. That was watered steel. He made it very clear. He says it several different ways, and that it was made at that location in his day, which was the 8th century. Now, in 1400 AD, we have Timur the Lame from Samarkand up in Uzbekistan. He came down, he sacked Delhi, he sacked Cairo, or was it Alexandria? Anyway, around that in Egypt there, and Damascus. And he burnt Damascus to the ground and took all of the craftsmen from there up to Samarkand.
Crazy.
And it's interesting, in later years, we see that Uzbekistan was a very, it was a main center of production of crucible steel. And then after that time period, after the 1400s, people say, hey, where's the Damascus steel being produced? And like, well, it's made kind of there somewhere or there, or they could never point to where it was being made, because other accounts, like in the 1500s, 1600s, they're talking about now that masses of steel from India are getting taken up and being going up through the Red Sea, Suez Canal, and then across to Damascus. And that was a major distribution point for the ingots. So that was very common. And even in the 8th century, they were still getting Indian steel there, because there is a historical account that talks about you can take either Indian steel or you can take Damascus steel. You can take either of these steels and you can make a good blade. It was a crucible steel. They were referring to this it on par with the Indian steel, which we'd call woots today.
Right. Crazy.
Yeah.
Do you mind giving me 2 seconds here? I'm a freaking idiot. I didn't bring my I didn't plug my laptop in to charge it.
Not
Make
a problem
sure you
at all.
Your laptop plugged in. Okay, 2 seconds.
Sure.
I'm very sorry about that, sir.
That's all right. Not a problem.
Man, this is awesome. The conversation I had last night, I feel like this is just it wasn't last night. It was Thursday night. This is just a continuation of that same conversation with a new twist to it. This is very cool, man.
One thing you'll find especially in woots, everyone has a piece of the puzzle. Sometimes they're wrong pieces. And then sometimes someone will have some pieces, another person will have others. And that's why the chat group was so fertile, because we could all put our pieces together and try and make them fit. And then we'd see, okay, well, that piece there is incorrect. And, there might be, this guy would say, one smith would say, oh, well, you if you do this, then you're going to get graphite. So you can't forge above this temperature and you can't roast it at this temperature. And then over here we say, well, we're doing that all the time. So what's the deal then? He's finding that and we're finding something different. And you come to realize that, okay, well, carbide forming elements retard graphite formation. So when you got very pure steel, he's right. When you have higher carbide forming elements, we're right. And so these sort of things, it was a massive education. It really was very, very fertile. So yeah, I've got I have a lot of respect for Rick. And and Kyle has been on a bit of a learning journey as well. So he's had an interest for a while, and he's just been trying to, as we all are, we're all still learning. We all make mistakes. There's been things where I've had understandings of things being a certain way, and then, I'll get picked up. It's like, oh, hold on. Well, that's different. And it's just, you got to be humble. You got to say, all right, thanks. I appreciate you correcting that. Let's move on.
I got to ask, I'm looking at how this unfolds, because I'm seeing this in more than just the Woot Society. Like, I'm not part of the Woot Society, so I don't have a deep insight into that. You're giving me the insight that I've got. And from that picture, I'm painting that within a group like that, within the group that I'm part of in the blacksmithing world, that sharing these ideas coming from a very personal side of things, this information is something that we have an attachment to, and thus forth it's something that we have a lot of passion about, right?
Correct. Yes.
Compare that to a corporate scenario per se, where you've got a group of engineers that are working together to create a product. You're not going to find that same effort put into the product that you're going to find in something like this, where everybody involved is doing it out of passion, not out of profit.
That's correct.
That's huge, man.
And that's where, we are. There's several of us who are working on, we're working on analysis. We're working on trying ancient formulations and working out how to get the best out of them. We can replicate pretty much, well, most of the ancient pattern types without any problem. On order, we can do that, because it's to do with elemental composition.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have the same elements, then it's going to be difficult to get the same sort of pattern, because the elements change things. Then you also have forging profiles, the temperatures, the times in the different stages. There's lots of information that we as a society have, and that we share amongst ourselves, that you just don't get it out there published. A lot of the, if you go by the published information, for example, and I say this, I have a lot of respect for John Verhoeven, and Al was my mentor. But if you follow the forging directions or profile information that they used back in their earlier papers, they talk about starting at 1250 degrees, forging down to non-magnetic, and they did that so many times, and you developed a banding pattern. Now, they were using Armco iron, and they were adding a little bit of vanadium, a little bit of phosphorus to it. And so if the average smith, and I've talked to many smiths who have said, yeah, we've tried that and it didn't work. And I'm not saying that it was incorrect information. I'm saying it was not qualified. And probably at that point, they didn't understand much. And so, we've got to give a lot of grace for where they were at the time. Because they were still in a learning process. And so essentially they were hitting it hard and fast. They were using a very large hammer, and it was a very pure piece of steel, not many impurities. And so they were able to get a good portion of the steel transformed from a dendritic structure to a, like a crystalline structure, to a lamellar structure with cluster sheets of carbides, which is what gives you the watering pattern.
Right.
And so, but if you follow their instructions, you don't have a really pure steel, mm-hmm. if you have a lot of carbide forming elements, and if you have a lot of, you've got a smaller hammer, you can't move it to the core in the first half of the heat.
Yeah, this came up with Rick as well. He was talking, and this is an issue that's becoming more prevalent in today's day and age, because as we move forward in the steel world, our recycled steels are really that's what you're getting is recycled steel for the most part. Almost anywhere you go, you're not finding fresh new steel almost anywhere. And that recycled steel is picking up who knows what in it. You know, they'll call it 1095 or 1084, but you're going to have microscopic traces of different elements in there, and that can be very problematic with woots.
Considering that, like, if you just take, like, 1018 or something like that, which some people do use 1010 or 1018 for a source material, that has between 0.45, I think it is, and 0.9% manganese. That's a relatively high level of manganese.
Quite a bit, yeah.
Traditionally, woots did not have that. Now, let me just quickly cover another misconception. People say, people make generalizations about woots. There is no one woots.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay. It was not made in one location. It was made in Spain by the Moors during their occupation. It was made in Egypt during the Mamluk Empire. It was made in Constantinople in Turkey. They had a demishikhane there, and they made some of the best swords at the location.
Mm-hmm.
It was made at Merv in Turkmenistan, which was at one point the capital of Persia.
Okay.
It was made in Khorasan. It was made down around the old area of Babylon in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It was made it was made in Damascus before the 8th century, according to the written accounts. So, and I have no reason to doubt the written accounts any more than the academics today. But academics tend to look at things and say, well, there's no physical evidence. Well, of course, it was burned to the ground, and it took like weeks for the fires to go out because it was burning the tar under the city. Well, yeah, nothing's left. So there's no archaeological evidence at all. And you wouldn't expect to find some. And they actually said there's actually accounts from before that time, city records talking about this quarter of the city was the steelwork, like the ironworks. And it was under the control of the head of the military kind of thing. They were making steel for iron and steel for weapons and stuff.
Right.
So, and that's in Cairo, they found that record. But then you have, it was made up in Uzbekistan. It was made, it seems, over in Mongolia. They had Ginti Bulat. Then it was made down, right throughout India, down to Sri Lanka. There's a lot of different places it was made. And there isn't even a possibility that the Greeks made it at some point. Because there's an account by Zosimos, it's the earliest recipe we have of crucible steel. And it dates back to, he was relaying something that was previously, came down to him. And so I think he might've been in Alexandria, which at that point was, I believe, under Greek control. But second century, it dates basically to the second century BC, this recipe, according to what the document is saying. And it was relayed through several different hands. But it said that it was developed in India. It went to the Persians. And he said, and it came from them, it came to us today.
Hmm.
and it's the process that's used today. And he gave the recipe. So that was 200 years before the time of Christ. It was, you know, also there's some people who say Wootz goes dates back to the, well, at least definitely the 4th century BC, but some go further and say it was the sixth century, etc. There isn't a lot of evidence for that. I'm not saying that it didn't. It's just we don't have the evidence. So the earliest recorded from a dig, the earliest piece of crucible steel that we have, that has been found, is from the 1st century AD.
Okay.
Yeah.
Crazy. When did the world kind of start diving into the world of creating steel from pig iron, or I guess when it went from pig iron to wrought iron to steel, right? Is that how it went?
It's not as clear cut as that.
Okay.
Because, and this is the guys on Iron Smelters of the World on Facebook. They have been doing a lot. Lee Sorter, Mark Green. They've been doing a lot of making bloomery iron, making hearth steel, that sort of thing. And they have shown that there would have been hearth steel being made back by practically every blacksmith since ancient times. It wasn't a common thing. Necessarily, they didn't make it in large quantities, but they could make steel. And even back in the Talmud, there in the Jewish historical writings, they talk about these, you know, steel that was hardened and how they quenched it and all that sort of stuff. And it's quite an interesting study. So we have hearth steel going back to before history. You know, it's before it was documented. We know that they would have had levels of it. It's just a matter of iron alloys don't last a long time in digs.
Right. Yeah, so yeah.
Especially the higher the carbon, the quicker they rot.
Makes sense, yep. For sure. So with the International Wootz Society, how does this work out for people that are interested in Wootz? If they want to get involved in the society, do they sign up as a member? Is there a yearly membership to be involved in it? And what do they get out of the membership exactly?
So currently the membership is $50 US per year. Okay. And which we wanted to set it at a level that was affordable for most people. And basically, you know, we don't draw a salary or anything. We don't get any benefit from it. And it's just, we've got to keep the wheels turning.
Yep.
On the society. And we've got, you know, hosting to pay for and various other things. And we also have projects that we are wanting to do for the benefit of the society as well.
Yep.
And so that's just like any non-profit organization. And so, yeah, you can go onto the website and click on register. Now, there's lots of people who go and they register, and it takes them to a screen where they can, you know, fill out their, put a bit of their details, set a picture and that sort of thing. And we're working to put more information on there at the moment because we've been having some struggles with that section of the website, updating it, updating fields for, you know, getting phone number and address so we can contact them.
If I might suggest to you, yep, we created a website here in Canada called smithless.ca.
Mm-hmm.
It is a directory of blacksmiths, farriers, blacksmith supply stores, events, cool, you name it. If it's blacksmithing related, we've got it up on smithless.ca. A gentleman by the name of Lauren Wanamaker was the guy that did all the website work. It was based off of my idea. And cool. I approached him and I was like, what can you do with this? He has done a phenomenal job setting that website up. He might be able to be helpful to you in that aspect. If you reached out to him, he might be willing to give you some hints and tips or even set you in the right direction of the person that can really get your website rolling for you, bud.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. We know what needs to be done at this point. They've recently upgraded the plugins that are available for the WordPress platform that we're using. So we can change, you know, the login screens and all that sort of thing now. which is a matter of getting around to doing it because we're all, we've got our own lives as well as that. It is a lot of work, yes.
Yeah, it is, man. Yeah. When it comes to that kind of stuff, I'm like, no, I don't have the patience for it. I don't have the time for it. Just here, you do it. How much is it going to cost me?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, we have, as I said, people can go on the website, they can register, but every single member has to be vetted first before we approve their membership. And so that can take up to a week sometimes. And that's simply because we want to make sure that they are genuinely interested in the community, yep. that they're genuinely interested in the furthering of the community and not just to come in, mine it for information, and then to do stuff outside of the community and make the equivalent of Pachymascus and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the whole thing is Woots is an artisan craft, and we are wanting to help to keep it as an artisan craft. Mm-hmm. So, and there's people who draw their livelihood from that. Some people, that's their sole source of livelihood.
Right.
And so we're doing everything. It's a delicate balance to be able to share information freely to those who genuinely want to further the community and become part of this wonderful thing that is Woots, and still be try and avoid those people who want to just get enough knowledge to go and make a whole bunch of cheap steel and flood the market and basically kill the business of the other members.
Yeah.
And so eventually it's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of Woots steel that's available out there. And that's part of the reason why we have the certification, so that the general public can say, oh, well, okay, is this person, either they are a really well-known name like Rick Furrer, they've got their experience, man. Or they can look at it and say, okay, is this person a member of the Woots Society?
Yeah,
are they a journeyman Wootsmith, etc.? So they can have a confidence in the product that's made, because it's easy to make rubbishy Woots. Just say if I was to make a bar and sell the bar, the quality that person, the knife made by that person, is not necessarily going to be the same quality as me, because I know how to heat treat it, etc. And even telling someone, this is how you heat treat it, this is what you do, there are still limits to their experience and knowledge. There's still a learning curve, even just heat treating it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I get, well, heat treating is so finicky, man. That's, to me, that is the real, the real cutting edge when it comes to the real, it's what creates the cutting edge.
Right.
But it's what's really the determining factor as to whether or not you're producing a quality item or not is the heat treat. I mean, you can spend all the time on forging and shaping an item, but if your heat treat isn't right, you're messing up. So, I mean, geometry plays huge aspects on cutting edge and whatnot too, but
yeah. You're right. And with Woots, that journey starts from the moment you put your ingredients in. So in the crucible, if you have iron oxide on your ingredients, you can get porosity, you can get problems if you don't know how to heat treat it, the ingot properly. If you don't know how to forge it properly, then you get all sorts of, back in the day, in the 1800s, 1700s, there was quite a great variety of, they had the same material being shipped to a whole bunch of different areas, and people got different patterns from the same ingot. They got from the same, batch of ingots. They had different qualities of steel. Some was really not too good, others was really excellent. And they also used to take the ingots in Persia and different places. They would melt the ingots down, and they would, dilute them with iron to make a lower carbon steel, which was then, tougher, etc. And maybe add some manganese or something in. Because people talk also in the community about doping of ingots, saying, oh, well, it's not real Woots because you put molybdenum in there, or it's not real Woots because you put this in there. And well, historically, they added chromium to some ingots. They added silver to some ingots. They added copper to some ingots. there was high levels of tungsten or molybdenum, depending on the location, you know, what was in the ore at the time.
Right.
And so, as I said, there is no one Woots. It is, you know, it was made over a massive area. Some is high in phosphorus, some is low in phosphorus, some is high in sulfur, where they added manganese to try and counter the sulfur.
Well, you know, the same thing exists in today's society. Take 1095 from one part of the world and 1095 from another part of the world, put it under a microscope or the spectrography there, and you're going to see differences.
That's correct.
Even from the same manufacturer, different batches will have different results in them. So it's impossible to have the exact same steel composition every freaking time.
That's right. And that's why, like John Verhoeven back many years ago, he did a test with a piece of Al's steel, and he compared it to 52-100 and a few other steels. And it was a cutting test, paper cutting test, you know, where they mounted in a machine and they cut, you know, so many thousand sheets, and then, you know, they measure how the edge performed, how many sheets they could cut before it stopped cutting, and all that sort of thing. So it's a good test. But it's, they were testing a piece of Al steel, which was a reproduction. It wasn't an original blade, and it wasn't, it didn't have the same elemental formation, and it's just one steel. So what they proved, which was good, they proved that it performed quite well, but not as good as some steels, and that when it was not as hard, so when they didn't take it to as great a hardness, it actually, in some cases, outperformed other steels.
Hmm.
So that was, but that was just one steel. They proved that Al steel could do that. They didn't prove that Woots historically could or could not do that. Mm. And this is why we've got to be careful in the research that we're doing. You know, research is great. It's important. We need more research, mm-hmm. but we have to be careful with the conclusions we draw from the research. And we mm-hmm. need to be careful with not making assumptions, because there's a lot of assumptions out there.
Hey, you're talking to somebody that works in research and development, man. I know.
Actually, Mert Tansu just recently made some stainless Woots. I mean, it's like forging on a coal anvil. It's great. It makes for fun forging. But he's a chef. You know, he worked as a chef over in the US and worked over here.
He's buddies with Fader, I think. I think that's where I've heard that name a bunch before, was through Jeff Fader on Knife Talk.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Mert's a great guy and makes excellent knives. And so, but he's been playing with Woots over the last several years, and he made this specific knife, stainless Woots knife, just for himself. And he said it outperforms any stainless that he has used.
Mm.
He said it's excellent. And he said that.
That's cool.
His favorite knife, favorite steel in the kitchen is Woots. He said just cuts like nothing else. Huh. And so, you know, Woots isn't traditionally supposed to be cutting paper. It's supposed to be cutting meat and vegetables and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's traditionally, they're the sorts of things that they're designed to be cutting. And of course, edge geometry comes in there as well. But there were the historical accounts of how sharp and effective Woots was. They would just go cut through arm, bone, everything in one swipe.
Right.
And over in India, you know, like the Sikhs still have swords, and they use them for slaughtering their food.
Yeah.
And
even modern day steels, I've seen videos of guys that have lobbed a freaking pig in half with a sword, or a big you know, cow splitter, whatever you want to call it, right?
Yep. So, and it's edge geometry and it's hardness of the steel. And so, but they use these for generations.
Yeah.
So sadly, a lot of these swords after the Indian Rebellion in 1850s, they had basically an amnesty, and they collected a lot of these things. They kept the museum pieces, things that were really important, and the rest they just chopped up for scrap.
Okay.
Yeah, sadly.
The world we live in.
That's actually going into the whole thing about people say that Woots died out. You know, the knowledge was lost. The technology of how to do it was lost. And people might even have heard the comment about the reason why it died out was because the ore ran out. That's a common piece of misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
The ore did not run out. It was made in thousands of sites across all of India, and of course other places outside of India. But the Indian Wootz, it wasn't just one ore deposit that they got it from, and it definitely didn't run out. And so the reason why basically the industry died, but the knowledge was not lost.
Mm-hmm.
And for case in point, well, we know that the industry died because of changes in technology, changes in weaponry, the ability, you know, the methods of warfare.
Yep.
Didn't require as many blades. It was more gun oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a bunch of famines over in India during the 1800s. It was horrible. Millions upon millions died. There was also cheap materials coming from England. And so you had competition, cheaper competition. And then what totally killed it was the weapons, the Arms Act, acts of the late 1850s, the 1860s, that basically prevented any person other than someone in on the side of or working for the military, the police, to actually carry a weapon. And so that just killed it. Before that, everyone had swords, everyone had you know, blades, etc. And you know, that's just very quickly that's how it kind of the things declined. But they were still making it to the 1800s. Actually, Jin, our historical officer, he comes from a Cicliger family, and the Cicligers were essentially, it means weapons maker. So his grandfather was a Cicliger, and he used to go up.
I feel like I could just let you talk for the next 2 minutes and I'll be right back.
No worries.
Okay, sorry, I'll be right back.
No worries. Not a problem at all.
Okay, awesome. Sorry. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so Jin's family, they're a Cicliger weapons-making family, traditionally, historically, and his dad grew up in the Punjab. His grandfather grew up in the Punjab, northern India, which basically near to where, just inside the Pakistan area, you know, Pakistan now. Which before partition, it was just all called Punjab. And so his mum remembers watching her dad making Wootz steel, making ingots. Mm. And she described the furnace that they used, etc., which is very similar to the historical accounts, just smaller. And so they would make it, and they would make it whenever it was needed. They had ore supplies close, etc. And then after partition, they in the 1940s, late 1940s, I think it was 1947, because of the violence and everything, they actually had to move to, 500 miles to the south or something. Mm. So that was difficult for them, and that took them away from their ore source. So after that time, he'd make a lot of other things as well, but he was just using up supplies that he was able to get along the way. He wasn't able to actually make Wootz after that time, but he was still forging it out, even up to to the point where gin in the 70s was going and forging with his grandfather and having him work with woots and that sort of thing. So that knowledge, there's a continuous line of woots makers, at least in that family, and we know that it was definitely made up until the 1800s, late 1800s, the early 1900s. So it didn't die out, but the knowledge didn't die, but the industry definitely did die.
Well, I mean, blacksmithing industry in general pretty much died. So it's not no surprise that the secrets of woots were, somewhat lost through that time, much like many of the blacksmithing secrets were essentially lost during that time too. There's, it never per se died and everything was lost, but there was a lot of people with a lot of knowledge that never got to pass that on because there was no one to pass it on to. There was no need at that point in time in our history to worry about using those steels in that manner. And even today, there's no need for us to use that steel. Instead of there being a need, it's more of a want nowadays, which, it's awesome that we're at that point, that we're able to do that in society now, where things aren't being done necessarily due to necessity, especially for war. I'm very happy to see that, that's not the case, that this isn't being driven by war, but it seems to be the way our world is. We're getting into political talks here. Let's stop that now. but it's of no surprise that that's where the development of woots came from as well, much as the development of almost anything in this world was based off of the fact that there was a need for it, and that need was usually war. It was either war, survival of some sort, right?
It was self-defense. It was offense. Mm. It was for tools. Right. They would make it use woots was made for tools. It was made for vessels. Different utilitarian vessels, boxes, etc.
Really?
Yeah, vases. Remarkable, some of the stuff that I've seen made of wood steel.
Would have never thought, that is pretty crazy to go to use woots into something like a vase or something like that. I've seen a lot of these guys are doing mokume into vases nowadays. Yep. And that to me is just the amount of work that goes into making that to turn it into a vase. It's like, wow, that's a lot of material, right? Versus something like a knife. The amount of material that goes into a knife versus what goes into a vase.
It's fine. It's thin. It's thin. They just forge it out into a sheet. Because armor was made, the armor was made out of woots as well.
Okay, yeah. Well, that would be awesome. Woots armor would be pretty awesome, I bet.
Yeah.
What about the brittleness to it? Is there an issue with brittleness on armor?
Not at all, because brittleness in woots comes from the elemental composition and the way it's heat treated. Mm-hmm. So the armor itself wouldn't have been heat treated. So it wouldn't have been hardened. It would have been quite tough.
Okay, interesting. Yep. Cool. Yep. So would woots armor dent then versus crack, or what would your suspect be on that?
Oh, I'm sure you could get it to crack with enough force, but it was better than the regular steel of other others. So, and that's one of the things with woots, because people say it's high carbon steel, but the high carbon, a lot of the carbon is quarantined in carbides, as Rick would say, diamonds in pudding. So you've got these high, very hard carbides, and if they're spheroidized carbides, then that's a very stable form. It's not brittle when it's spheroidized, because you've got all this lower carbon steel. The steel, if you have full decent precipitation of the carbides in the steel, then in between the carbides is going to be in the 0.8% carbon eutectic steel. So that's going to be right. What's it called? Utectoid, I think that it is. I always get that mixed up. But anyway, you've got, it's about, what, 0.8% carbon, which is the limit of what iron will, in equilibrium, will hold carbon to. And so, and then the other bits and the little carbides, bits of carbon start precipitating out as hard particles. And so depending on how you heat treat that, they can either be very blocky. It can be like glass in the steel. So, you know, when you hit it, it shatters and it fractures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why people, you know, people don't know how to treat that when they're forging it. And so there's been two things. One has been accounts which have been misattributed. So they'll take a tempering account and say it's a forging account. So it's like, okay, this is for heat treating, but they're saying, oh, they forged out the ingot at that temperature. No, they just heat treated it at that temperature. There's others where they say that it was forged when black. They forged it cold. Does that mean they forged the entire ingot cold? No, it means that they were looking at the blade being planished.
Right.
Which a lot, you know, like the Japanese, they do that. They planish the high carbon steel blades. And so we have to open our minds a little bit and have a little bit of context when we're interpreting some of these old accounts. Also, when they say that they talk about a cherry red, which some accounts do, cherries, as Rick would say, weren't that same color. Mm-hmm. They're not the same color as we see today. A cherry red today is a dark red. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was a bright orange.
And it would also depend the light that you're standing in too, right? Are you in a dark room? Are you outside?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and Rick actually was the first one who put me onto that when we were talking about stuff. And he said the colors weren't the same back then. I was like, oh, that makes a whole lot of sense. And I just started digging in, looking at the old paintings from that time period. And it's like, he was right.
Well, just cherries in general can be different colors depending where you are in the world too.
That's right. But back then, the most predominant variety of cherry in Europe was that brighter color.
Right.
Yeah. Huh. So old paintings are great resources.
Interesting. Yeah. That's
so depending cool. on how you forge, you forge things out, you can get either have it cracking, or you can take the same ingot, you can forge it out one way and it'll crack. You forge it another way under different conditions, and it won't. And you can forge it really high in temperature, and yeah, it'll move fast, and it'll make a really nice, good piece of steel. Or you can have it crumble under your hammer. It all depends on how you forged it out. And these are the sort of things that we teach people in the society. This is how you do this. This is how you do that. This is how you avoid getting graphite, getting porosity in your steel. All sort of stuff. So,
I just ran into a mistake on that aspect with S7 last night. I had to swap the propane tank halfway through the night because I was running on my little 40-pounder. 40-pounder ran out. Okay, well, I got the 100-pounder filled. Let's swap it over to the 100-pounder. Set her up here. Got it all running. Okay, yeah, she's good. Threw my block back in the forge. Turned around, did a little bit of paperwork or whatever I had going on the bench there. Okay, go back to the forge. Oh, shit, the flame's coming out of the forge pretty good. Shoot, I must have turned up the propane a little bit too much. Oh, well, pull my piece out, go to the press, start pressing it out a little bit. Okay, yeah, great. Go to throw it back in the forge, and as I'm walking back to the forge, I look and I'm like, oh, that's a weird-looking piece of scale that's coming off of it now. That's a crack.
Yeah. Wet sand cracks.
Yeah. Too hot, right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So you can get wet sand cracks from either forging it too hot or not dissolving enough carbon in, it's not letting it sit long enough.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it sat long enough. I'm sure that that's not the issue. I'm pretty sure that I got it.
So you hit the mushy zone.
Yeah.
It's what we call the mushy zone. So you get to a point where some of the elements, and that changes depending on the chemistry of the steel.
Okay.
So you get to a point where either it will start, if it's too hot, it'll start to just kind of fall apart in the forge.
Uh-huh.
But it can be below that temperature, and then when you start pressing it or forging it, that transfers energy, which increases the heat, and it can be below the mushy zone. You start pressing it, it goes above the mushy zone, and you get a wet sand crack.
Oh, dude, that's totally what happened, for sure. Totally.
Yep. Easy enough to do. Very easy to do.
I'm so glad that I brought that up, man. That I just learned something big there, for sure. That's awesome. Cool. The mushy zone.
Yeah, that's right. Oh. Yep.
We refer to the mushy zone as something a little bit different when we go camping, if you know what I'm saying. But
oh yeah, yeah. Yep.
You know what? I bring this up every episode because Maritime Knife Supply is a company that supports the podcast, and we support them because they support us. If you have head over to Maritime Knife Supply, they are the number one supplier for anything knife related in Canada. They ship to the United States. I'm sure that Lawrence would be willing to ship worldwide, but it probably doesn't make sense if you've got suppliers in Australia. Why would you order from Canada? But regardless, if you're in Canada, the United States, Lawrence has extremely fast shipping across all of North America. He has extremely competitive prices. He is now a distributor in Canada for Broadbeck Ironworks 2x72 belt sanders. If you order 10 belts from him, you'll get one for free, because he's got a deal where you buy 10, get one for free. And if you use the code FSCKILN at checkout while buying a Evenheat or Paragon Kiln, you'll save yourself $100. You can ask TJ Bremner all about that. He used the code just recently and saved himself $100 on an Evenheat kiln. Congratulations, TJ, once again. Head over to maritimeknifesupply.ca. Use that code if you can. If not, pick up yourself 10 belts, save 10%, and say good day and take off, you hoser.
Awesome. They sell a fair bit of native handle materials and that sort of thing, don't they, as well?
Yes, Lawrence has an amazing selection of handle material from woods and micartas and G10s and pinstock and brass, stainless, copper, all, and every tool steel you can think of, man. He's also a distributor for Baker Forge and Forge Steel. All that Damascus that Baker Forge is making, he's a distributor for it as well. So
cool.
Really, really awesome stuff coming out of there. I gotta wonder, so prior to Woots, did you play around in the powdered welded steel at all? Was that kind of the jump to it, or did you just skip that altogether?
I skipped that altogether. I mean, I made my first knife. I mean, you know, I didn't excuse me, before I got into making my own steel, before I got into blacksmithing, I was still making knives. I think my first knife was made out of mild steel in my shed back here in Melbourne. I must have been 15.
Nice.
And I made it out of mild steel, knew nothing about hardening or tempering or anything. It turned out all right. I put an acrylic handle on it with brass pins. Didn't do a bad job, and it wouldn't hold an edge. And I was like, what's going on here? So that was when my learning process started. And then I made a stiletto out of brass just for the fun of it, for your hand filing. Then I made a Crocodile Dundee knife over in America. And I think the first knife that I made where I really actually I sent that one off to heat treat. The first one I heat treated was a Damascus. I can't remember the guy. Starts with E. The guy, the name who made Eckersley or someone. He was just a really nice piece of high layer 1095 Damascus. I think it was probably 1095, 15, and 20. Mm-hmm. And it was great. That knife, I took it up on up to Boundary Waters when I went up there for a couple of weeks, and I used it for everything. Just I used it as an axe. It was like a hunting knife, you know, 4-inch blade hunting knife. But you know, I used timber to bludgeon it, and you know, split wood and carved with it, and it could still shave when I got back.
Nice.
So you know, doing proper heat treat, it's. That's the thing. You've got to really, you know, with Woots or anything else, you've got to spend the time, normalize, know your steel, heat treat it properly, and yeah, it's not all about hardness.
Is Wootz generally a water quenching steel?
That depends.
Uh-huh.
We're creeping back into the making assumptions about Wootz, because it's kind of like saying, is carbon steel water quenching?
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got W2, you've got O1, you've got all these different steels, which are all carbon steels, which are similar to each other, slightly different elemental compositions. And Wootz is the same way. So, yes, you can quench some Wootz in water. If you want a hard quench, there are some situations where you do need to use water. Some you want to fine oil. It's a matter of knowing your steel. And I like to recommend to people who are making Wootz, once you've made your bar, don't just kind of jump in and hope that you're getting your heat treat right. Forge out a series of wedges.
Right.
So take take a small blade or make like a bevel, and then cut it into sections, about a centimeter, half an inch wide, and about a couple of inches long, and then just find out for that particular formulation. Try different heat treating methods, different temperatures, because sometimes you have to let it sit long enough to get the carbon into solution, enough carbon in solution for it to actually harden.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, like, I made the mistake in early years of it didn't harden. All right, well, I'll just increase the temperature. Still didn't harden. Mm-hmm. Increase the temperature. And I didn't realize that I had to let it sit for longer to get that carbon in solution, because the carbides have to start diffusing carbon into the steel.
Yeah. The carbon has to get to that point where it's at that excited mode and it's doing its jiggy dance, right?
That's right. Exactly. So, I just suggest do several tests. Then you'll know. Before you do your good blade, and if you've got a 2 kilo ingot that you've made, or even 1.5 kilos, it's quite a bit. You've got a bit to play with. And then once that formulation is done, you keep your recipe, you know the elements that are in there. And once you've worked out for that particular formulation, this is how you heat treat it, just write it down. And I have what are called forging diagrams that I came up with years ago. And I encourage other smiths to use them. Basically, on one side, it's got temperature in degrees. And also I have a color bar there, so it shows the color temperature of the steel.
Nice.
And then the other axis is time, basically. And so if I do, say, if I soak the ingot at 1100 degrees, that changes depending on the chemistry of the ingot, what you want to soak it at. I do a diffusion heat. So I'll do a diffusion heat, and then I'll write there, okay, so many hours at this temperature, and I'll draw a line.
What's a diffusion heat?
Okay, so you can do diffusion heats at high temperature or low temperature. Basically, it's just getting the carbon to move in the steel. And so above, if you are familiar with the phase diagram, iron-carbon phase diagram, above ACM, that's the austenite-cementite line.
Right,
you start getting the cementite dissolving. Yeah. And if you leave it there long enough, it will completely dissolve.
Right.
And then you'll have maybe some carbides left, but all the iron carbide, all the cementite will have dissolved. And okay. So at that point, letting it sit, Al used to sometimes do like even up to a 30-hour roast.
Whoa.
Yeah. That
what
was so he said if you went too much longer than that, you'd start getting problems. But he'd let it sit at 1150 degrees centigrade, and he'd let it sit there for 15 hours or more. And it helps to homogenize your pattern. So the elements tend to homogenize a little bit more. So he claimed that it made the banding a little bit wider.
Huh.
Whether it did or not, That's a matter for debate. It depends on chemistry and a few other things. But
I'm sure, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Everything depends on chemistry. yeah. So, yeah,
what about cryogenic treating on these things?
I don't know any Smiths who do cryogenic or have tried cryogenic heating on it. Because it's such a high carbon, I would think that would really cause extra stress. It's like, for example, you have to adjust, just like with kitchen knives. You look at kitchen knives and you've got a particular elemental analysis. They say it's got so much vanadium, so much molybdenum, so much this, that. They put those in there for a reason. And of course, manganese, they put that in there for hardness, etc.
Right.
With high carbon steels, you know, and thin blades, you struggle with warping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really heavily struggle with warping. And so you have to add things which increase your hardenability, etc.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it depends on what, and this is the whole thing. We're trying to teach Smiths not only how to make good steel, but how to tailor it to your particular usage. And I can guarantee anyone who joins the society who knows not much about Woots, it will be a bit of an information
overload.
Yeah,
it already is. Like that conversation I had with Rick and Kyle, my mind was it's fucked up. I almost felt depressed the next day.
Really?
But yeah, it was because, I don't know, have you ever gone through that where you go through something in life that was just so intense that you feel just kind of messed up the next day?
Yeah, well, I've been writing a book on Woots, and so it's a how-to manual and talking about the history and myths and all that sort of stuff. And so I'm getting close to the illustration phase. I get almost done, and then I have to write another 10,000 words. It's just not fair.
10,000 words? Oh, my God.
Wow. So I think I'm already up to, I don't know, close to 50,000 words on it.
How many pages?
That depends on the number of pictures I put in there.
Oh, man. Exciting. That's exciting, dude. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that, man. That's awesome. Sweet, yeah. Dude.
And it helps to explain, you know, the metallurgy behind it. And you know, you can't really be good at making Woots unless you understand the material and why it does what it does and why you do what you do to it. Just giving a recipe saying you do this, you do that, until something changes or something is unexpected pops up, then you're in trouble. But I've totally gotten that feeling when I've done the deep dive. Also, not just research of the book, but one of the things that we're trying to do with the society is to make sure all our members are on the same page as far as history, myths, misconceptions, etc. So when they talk on, you know, just like everybody else, they have some correct information, some incorrect information.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to get them all on one page, and we're working on an associate certification, which each of the Smiths goes through to understand this whole, all these different areas, and it'll be a, you know, presentation that we do, several sessions, and so doing the research for that, I've had to do the deep dive on a lot of different areas, and sometimes I'll do like 2-3 days of just this deep dive, and then I just have to put it down and not look at it, not touch it, not think of it for like a week or so, because your head just feels fried. Feels like you're in a whirlwind of thoughts and stuff.
I'll be honest, man. I almost had to cancel this on you because I was worried that that's where my brain was at right now. I was like, man, I don't know if I can handle another one of these conversations right now.
Well, I look forward to listening to the interview with Rick.
Yeah.
And Dr. Woots, Kyle.
Absolutely awesome gentleman to talk to. We wanted to keep going. It was so hard to put the phone down. Well, the phone down, turn off the browser, whatever. Yeah. Right. I'd like to dive into some real quick questions with you about your history as a blacksmith. Kind of like a rifle off a question real quick. give a quick basic answer to it, then move on to the next question type thing.
Okay.
What was your first anvil?
Ah, well, it's an antique and it has no name. It's 150 pound. So it's the one I got back in. I've still got it. Nice. I got it back in 99, something like that. Yep.
So, you remember where you got it and who you got it from and all that?
Yeah, I got it from Ken Sharabok. So nice. That's what got
me
started.
That's right.
Yep.
Great. Cool.
I've still got it. It's still here. I brought it back in the shipping container from America.
Nice. Okay, and real quick here. much love to my friend Nick Verbray. This question comes from him. Tell me about your favorite hammer.
Oh, well, favorite hammer. Look, I use a German cross peen. Yeah, that's most frequently. So I've got a hammer on order. It's a birthday present, delayed birthday present, belated.
Who's that coming from?
It's coming from Seth Wood from Killer Cranky Forge.
Oh yeah. Nice.
Seth is awesome. He lives up the coast from me, just inland a little bit.
He's actually a regular listener of the show too.
Yeah. Seth's awesome. Yeah. So, nice guy, fellow ham operator, and he's making a rounding hammer for me. So when he gets, he's slowly working through bits and pieces. He's been trying to get his power hammer up and running, but has been having some power issues. It's hard to get electricians who can do stuff inland. Yeah, you get into more remote areas and you're in trouble.
He has had issue after issue when it comes to his blacksmithing, man. It's unfortunate to see. And he's so good.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's only one other person in Australia that I would want a hammer from, and that would be Sam Towns.
Yep. Sam, he's a nice guy, too.
Yeah. Nice guy. Nice guy.
And he's got a pretty good voice, too.
Hell yeah. I can't get enough of their show. They were a huge catalyst to pushing me into becoming a podcaster and doing what I'm doing here. Yeah. So much love to those two gentlemen, Alex Norden and Sam Towns over at the ForgeCast. What are you running for major tools? Oh, this is where the tool lady comes out. Tell me about your tools. What are some of the major tools that you're running in your shop? Do you got a power hammer? Do you got a press? What size of kiln are you running? Heat treating oven?
Okay, so I have a 55 kilo Runfa two-piece hammer,
nice.
Which is it's nice. It's the maximum that I could get in the space and that could run on my 80 amp house line. So
yeah.
It's running on a VFB.
Turn everything in the house off when the hammer's running?
Well, no, it's not that bad. It's a 40 amp line out to the workshop, and that handles it. Although I had to upgrade the line because when I first installed it and powered it up, it was like a disco. chug, and the lights were all dim, So I'm quite happy with that hammer, and so I've got that, and I've got hardness testers. I've got I don't use a press. That's maybe down the road, but some smiths use presses for woots quite heavily. And I guess, I have fewer tools than most smiths because I've specialized from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so I've only had just what I needed for making woots and for grinding. I made my own belt grinder years ago, and I've still got it there. It needs a bit of work, but recently, just before COVID, I went out and I got a 84 Engineering 72x2 grinder, and that's a sweet machine. It really is. They're brilliant, and so I've got that. I've got quite a few lathes. Quite a few lathes.
Wow, that's not something you hear from a lot of people. I've got quite a few lathes. Not a couple, not a few, quite a few.
Well, I've got an old Sears, I've got Sears Craftsman, I've got a, I don't know what, that's a Mars lathe, which I've got to put a new motor on, but it's actually in quite nice condition, just needs a bit of tweaking. And I've got a 3-in-1, you know, drill mill lathe.
Thing, oh, yeah. Which is, like a shop smith kind of thing.
Exactly. That's what it is. Yeah. Yeah. Chinese shop smith. So that's rather nice. And I've got my woodworking shop right in the middle of my workshop too. I've got a 8x12 meter shed, which has a kitchen sitting in it right now. So as soon as I get the extension done, I'll be able to get back out there and actually be able to bash out some more steel.
8x12 meter shed. Now, okay. In context, hearing that, you're like, oh yeah, 8x12, that's not very big. Shed, not very big. No, 8x12 meters is actually pretty damn big, dude, because
it's like a 4-car garage.
That's not a shed, buddy. That's a shop.
It's a workshop. That's hell nice. Yeah. My first workshop was a goat shed. That was on Seed Tick Farm in Tennessee. And I tell you, the ticks, they were bad. The ticks and the rattlesnakes. Apart from the ticks and the rattlesnakes, I loved it. It was great over there. Lots of deer, lots of turkey, good fishing. Yeah.
Ticks are terrible. I can't. Do you guys get ticks in Australia?
We do have some ticks. Yes, we have paralysis ticks. You got to be. Yeah, if dogs can have major problems, and even people too, it can kill people if you're not careful. Because the paralysis, it affects the lungs and all that sort of stuff as well.
Oh, damn. I thought I hated ticks already. Now I hate them even more. Frick. Yeah, that's... I know we get one here in North America. They're calling it the... I think they called it the Lone Star Tick.
Lone Star Tick, yeah. Carries Lyme's disease.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's the one you got to really watch out for.
Yep. Lone Star Eye. I used to work with a vet clinic over in Nashville, outside of Nashville. And... I think it was in Brentwood. But anyway, it was run by a mate of mine. And so we had a lot of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme's disease, Ehrlichia, all that sort of stuff. Major tick-borne.
Rocky Mountain diseases. Spider feet?
Spocker. Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
What's that?
Okay, so it's basically you get a bullseye on your... around the bite, kind of a red bullseye, and then you get fever and all nasty sorts of stuff. And so it's like Lyme's disease, just different.
Doesn't last as long. Lyme disease can last ten years or something, right?
Rocky Mountain spotted fever can last a long time. Yeah,
fuck, I hate them. I said I'm moving back north. I come from a town called Flin Flon, Manitoba. It's about a 9-hour drive north of where I live now.
Right.
There was no ticks there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got chickens on the property here that just free range and they eat up a lot of the ticks. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Excuse me. Yeah. So that is one thing. We have Lyme's disease over here as well. And actually the Lyme's disease in Tennessee, there's no test for, at least back when I was there, there wasn't. But it was carried by a different type of tick, and it was a slightly different variety. So the tests would not actually, come back positive. So we used to treat for it regardless of whether, if they had the symptoms, we'd treat, because you can get false negatives and false positives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've heard that before too, man. So, back to the quick questions, I kind of derailed there a little bit. Do you have a favorite style of knife that you like to make?
I would say that bushcraft type knives. I started out with those, and I like all sorts of knives, but I like knives that are very functional.
Yeah.
And the sort of knife that's, on your belt, you pull it out, you use it every day. It's all there. It's like your companion.
What about axes?
I haven't made any. I've got a Grandsforce Brux, which is rather nice. Love those.
Would Damascus be...
It would be good, yes. Because they used to make battle axes out of woots.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Rad. That's, I didn't know that. I've never heard of that, man. That's so cool.
Yeah. I'd like to make some eventually. I'd like to make some woots hammers.
Oh, yeah.
Woots hammers and woots axes, that sort of thing. That'd be cool. And of course, the thinner you forge the woots, the more dramatic the pattern gets. Often.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'd probably end up doing a laminate type thing, where I'd have the cheeks woots and maybe another steel in the middle, or I'd just take woots on woots sandwich.
Woots on frickin' rot, dude. That's like that's the new thing now, hey? The hip mascus, we're putting rot in the center.
Yeah.
Dude, woots on that would be pretty cool.
But do they actually put rot in the center? I thought they used a higher carbon steel in the center or something like that.
No. A lot of guys, what they're doing right now is they're using a rot body and then putting steel faces on it. Yeah.
Oh, really? And how do they get the hardness? Do they carburize it? Because rot does not have a high carbon steel, high carbon level.
So I'm going to refer to my friend DK Smalls that's been doing this. He'll put a 1045 face on his hammers with a wrought iron body.
Oh, now I got you. Sorry, I was thinking blade. No.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
You're talking here, I'm thinking there. Sorry.
Sorry, my apologies.
It's okay.
I kind of thought that too. I wasn't sure. Hammers are... That's kind of my jam, hammers and axes. I've never been into the knives per se, but I think this woots thing might suck me in, man. It just might.
Be careful. Once it's got its teeth in you, it doesn't let go.
It's already happening, so. I got to wonder, if I wanted to get into woots, what am I going to be looking at having to acquire?
Okay, so there is no one who makes, at this point, there's no one who makes a furnace just off the shelf. So you have to make your own furnace or have someone make it for you who already makes woots. Okay. That's usually a cast refractory shell liner.
Right.
Backed with KO wool, ceramic wool.
Yep.
And so then, it's got to be high temperature, 1700, 1800 degree refractory cement, and then so you make that. I make mine in a keg these days.
In a keg? Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I get the
steel keg, not an aluminum one, right?
Stainless steel keg.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the squat fat ones, you know.
Yep.
So because the narrow ones, they're nicer, but they don't have quite the diameter that I need to get that insulation in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have options of burners. You can use either a Venturi burner. Some smiths use that.
Really?
But it's more difficult to use a Venturi burner. It's more of a juggling act because they're very sensitive to back pressure.
Yeah.
And so generally speaking, you want to use a blown burner.
Yeah.
And they're pretty, like a Mongo or something like that. You know, like one of the real Ron Real burners from... Yeah. Years ago. Excuse me. And just a regular, like one of those squirrel cage blowers.
Yeah.
That works fine. Like you'd use for a forge, a large one for a forge or something.
Yeah.
Some people have talked about using ribbon burners for furnaces, but I haven't seen it work. That I wouldn't see it work. But you know, you've got a lot of heat there and you're starting to get fine, thin parts there which can melt. You know, the internal walls of a furnace, because the heat, even with 1800 degree refractory, will vitrify. Mm-hmm. It will fuse, it will crack. And I don't know how that would handle, a ribbon burner would handle that.
Right.
So you need that, of course, you know, just... Anvil, like I used, you don't need a power hammer. It's nice.
I like the way you say that. It's nice.
Right. So I used to use a 16-pound sledgehammer one-handed.
Wow. Dude, yeah. How's your shoulder been?
Oh, fine. It's technique. Wow. Just like it's like Yuri Hoffi. I love the way he approached forging. It's not about the weight that you're swinging. It's about how you swing it.
You know what? And on that note, I have to pause for a second. We lost a great man there, and may he rest in peace.
Indeed. Yeah, he definitely was an innovator and someone who looked at the world uniquely. Right. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Did a lot for the blacksmithing community, that's for sure.
Yeah, he did. So it saved a lot of arms and wrists.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I used to I'd swing back, swing up like a pendulum.
Yeah.
Get up to about here and then push up and then let it fall. Boom.
Yep.
And I do that. Swing up and down.
Yeah.
Up and down. And so
and the downward force from your end would be minimal. You'd let the hammer do the majority of the work. Yep.
Yeah. You're not pushing the hammer, you let gravity do its work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mind you, that's not the best way of doing it. Get a striker. Seriously, yeah. If you're going to do it by hand, get a striker.
God, tell me about it. Tell me about it. Yeah. I have gotten to the point in my life now where I am done swinging anything over a 4-pound hammer. Yep. People have been bugging me to make them hammers, and I'm like, well, the problem is I used to make hammers by hand. I ain't making hammers by hand anymore. Screw that, man. I'm so done doing that. If I make another hammer by hand, it's for me or my daughter maybe one of these days. I'm not making them for anybody else that way. Unless they want to pay me an exponential amount of money, by all means, go for it. But
yeah. Well, that's, you know, Seth. Seth, up until now, has been forging solely by hand with sledgehammers. So making all sorts of sizes of hammers. He's
Same thing with DK Smalls there. He does everything by hand. If you go to listen to his episode, it was like 4 hours long, and at I think the last 2 hours of the episode was an argument as to what hand forging is and whether or not you should use a power hammer or not use a power hammer or a press and this and that. It was a freaking, oh, we almost started throwing shit at each other. It was amazing.
Well, excuse me. That's something that going back to the press thing for a moment, you know, there are smiths who are using presses and rollers. But traditionally, there are trade-offs. Yeah, there's a trade-off
with everything, for
sure. Everything, yes.
Yeah.
And so in the old days, you know, you'd have a 3-person team. It would be the son of the blacksmith who was operating the blower on the forge. It would be the father who was holding and guiding the tool and maybe using a small hammer. And the wife would be standing, he'd be squatting, the wife would be standing using a, not too heavy, but using a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
And so the wives would be the strikers.
Nice.
And yeah, so they, you know, just don't get in their way. You've got to be nice to them.
You ever seen that that picture of the blacksmith with the pot on his head and the woman standing with the sledgehammer?
Oh,
yeah. That's what instant thought of that picture came to mind.
Oh yeah, yeah. So that's one thing that they used to, you know, they'd use a striker, and then they would also. They wouldn't heat the whole piece of steel all at once. They'd they'd heat an area and they'd forge that area. Then they'd heat another area and forge that area. And so you had a lot more variation in the internal structure got kneaded in a much more irregular fashion. And so that created a lot more wateriness to the pattern. And so you can't get the same patterns, the same characteristics. You can still get a watered pattern, you can still get a dendritic pattern, you can get grain boundary cementite pattern. Yeah, there's different pattern structures, core structures you can have, but the individual characteristics, the way it looks on the surface, because a lot of it is surface deformation and just through either temperature or surface deformation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got chemistry as well. So sounds simple, but it's actually quite complex. And so, yeah, if you're forging something, if you're rolling it evenly, it's pushing it evenly, you get nice laminar sheets. But then the pattern can be a little boring. And so you've got to spend a bit more time there before you finish off the blade doing that surface deformation, just like you would with regular Damascus.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh. Very cool. Very cool. What about, okay, so the foundry, I get what you need, or the furnace, I get what you need for a mm-hmm. furnace. My understanding is you want to have powdered steel to do this, right?
Okay, so you can use flakes of electrolytic iron. You can use sponge iron.
What's sponge iron?
Okay, so sponge iron is sintered. It's basically, it's where they take the ore and they put it in a furnace with carbon dioxide,
okay.
I think it is. And then that converts the oxide to raw metal without combustion.
Huh.
So it doesn't melt. It just kind of fuses. And so you had this end up having a powder, which comes out the other end. And so that's sponge iron. It does have alumina and silica in it, but that will, generally speaking, float out in your melt as flux,
right,
as slag. It'll rise out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can get quite good quality, especially Haganas products. They're always good if you can get them. Iron products are getting more expensive. So, and that's why we have they're not available to everybody in every location. And so we've got some smiths who are down in Argentina. And so, you know, with the government over there is very strict with letting things out of the country and letting things in.
Yeah.
Very controlling type of government. And so it makes it hard for them to get supplies. And so they've had to get creative with how they make their furnaces, creative with their materials, etc. And so we have a couple of bits of information which are available to the smiths. One talks about common pitfalls that a smith will make in making woots. I've seen it all.
mm-hmm.
But it helps them dodge the landmines. And then there's another one which talks about how to work out your recipe with the materials that are available in your region. There's various different types. I mean, look, you can use, 1018 if you want. It is high in manganese, means you've got to put extra vanadium in. You can't make really high carbon steel, like, you know, up in to the 1.678. You want to be making it more down the 0.5 or 1.5, 1.4% carbon levels. Because
that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, but so then it's because manganese actually will, too much manganese masks your pattern. It'll kind of choke your pattern out. It competes. Manganese makes dark carbide. And so it competes for carbon with your carbide-forming elements, which make white carbide.
Right.
And so you get this darkening of your blade. And eventually, if you have too much, it'll just choke it out. It'll just look muddy and dirty and with very little pattern at all.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, my man, Timothy, we have, according to the Zencaster program, 1 minute left of chat time here. I'd like to continue the conversation, but at the same time, I think we've kind of gotten the majority of our information across here that we need to get across.
Sure.
I think it'd be an all right time to say it, our goodbyes, but
sounds good. That's fine.
Oh man, yeah, it's telling me I've got 0 minutes left now. I don't know if it's actually still recording or not. I think it is. I hope it is.
Okay.
If it's not, this is hopefully it catches this, and this is the outro we do every show. I don't have somebody to back me up on it, so try to emulate what I do here. Okay, ready for this?
Cooey. That's the Australian version, mate.
Nice. I love it. Good day, gents. Thank you very much, Timothy.
It's been great. Thanks, Lando. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you have a good day.
You too.